Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. And if you guys are driving while you're listening to this episode, it will really hit home because today's episode is car focused. And I just want to say, if you're not a car person, I don't consider myself to be extremely well versed with cars, you will still enjoy this episode. I just want to say that before you click off and you're like, oh my God, a car episode? No, thank you. This one is actually very interesting. I stumbled across a little blurb about this on one of my various history websites that I love to just pore over every single day because I am a nerd. And I saw this like one-liner about how, you know, I don't even want to spoil it by telling you guys, like, why would I do that at the top of the episode? No, Katie, come on, get it together. What I want to kind of allude to is the fact that there are so many inventions related to cars that are so shocking and that I just don't feel like many people know about. And a lot of these stories that I'm going to tell you guys today in terms of, you know, where these inventions, these very common things that you would just like see in a car and not think much about, a lot of these are going to be, you know, good little party tricks for you to pull out, you know, next time you're in a long Uber drive somewhere, you're headed to a concert or to a wedding or something, and you're in a car and you're just like, oh, so I've run out of things to say. You can bring up these fun little facts about car inventions and how a lot of them truly were created for the greater good, like not to make a buck, but for the greater good of getting around and staying safe. Listen up and buckle up. I've been dying to say that. Buckle up because we are going on a trip today. As some of you out there listening might know, I live in New York City. I've lived in the city for 6 years now, and I haven't had a car since I was in college. I didn't feel like I had a need for a car moving to the city. I take a lot of public transport. Like, I'm constantly taking the subway places, walking if I can, you know, hailing a taxi, taking an Uber. I get around town just fine without a car. And I feel like a lot of New Yorkers would say, you know, having a car, unless you have a need to like get to work or you have kids you need to take to school or whatever, you don't really need a car in the city. And though I don't own a car, I still think about cars quite a lot. I was actually in a taxi the other night thinking about, you know, the concept of taxi cabs in New York City, how they're such an iconic visual, you know, seeing a taxi cab just whipping by, and in movie scenes, you know, that iconic scene in How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days when she's on the bridge in a taxi about to go to DC and Matthew McConaughey's character chases her down in his little motorcycle, I think it was a motorcycle. And, you know, New York City taxi cabs is such an institution, right? Culturally. And now with the influx of Ubers and whatnot, you know, it's kind of threatening the culture of the taxi cab, I feel like. And I was just thinking the other night to myself, I'm like, I hope to never live in New York City when there aren't taxi cabs. Like, I don't know why I said taxi cabs, like taxi cabs. But anyway, that got me thinking about cars in general, and I was also in the process of watching the new Bridgerton season, and I was thinking about, you know, horse-drawn carriages and stagecoaches and just how far we've come in the realm of getting from point A to point B, and how, you know, when we're sitting in the back of an Uber or driving our own car, there's so many things in said vehicle that really did not exist. Like, they're newer than you'd think. Like, you kind of get used to, you know, seeing certain elements of a car. And of course, every year, more and more things come out, right? Like self-driving cars, things like that. But there are very common elements of a car that we really don't give much thought to. For example, have you ever wondered about windshield wipers? Windshield wipers were actually invented by a woman named Mary Anderson. The story goes that while touring the city of New York, of course, in a trolley car on a snowy day in the early 1900s, she conceived her idea of a windshield wiper blade that could be operated from inside of the trolley car by the trolley driver. During her ride in the trolley car, she observed that drivers often had to open their windows in order to see where they were going in bad weather. Sometimes they had to stop altogether to go inside to clear off the window. Her idea consisted of a lever inside of the vehicle that controlled a spring-loaded arm with a rubber blade. The lever, with a counterweight to keep the wiper in contact with the window, could move the blade across the windshield, removing rain or snow. Like, I just, in my mind, can hear the sound of a windshield wiper blade. Like, you guys know, it's such an iconic, LOL. Can you tell I haven't driven a car in a while? It's iconic. No, it's just a very memorable, very like familiar sound to me. But with her 1903 patent, Mary Anderson's invention proved to be the first windshield clearing device to be effective. Founded by a woman. We love it. As driving became more prevalent, it was eventually adapted for use on all vehicles in the US, not just trolley cars. In fact, Cadillac made it a standard piece of equipment in their cars by 1922. And this is just crazy to me that windshield wipers weren't really in use/patented before this time period. But I guess it makes sense, I've had many instances where windshield wipers have been the reason I didn't end up, knock on wood, dead in the ditch. And I guess that's just, that's it. Without windshield wipers or an efficient way to clear things off of the windshield, I think people were just, confined to driving in good weather conditions or risking it all / having to pull over, like I said, the trolley cars had to do, and manually just like scraping the snow and rain off, or whatever you have on there, ice, etc. Such a hassle. So yes, windshield wipers were invented by a woman who noticed something in a trolley car. Fun fact. Another fun fact, let's talk about the invention of cruise control. This is something that I'm sure a lot of you guys out there, you could be using it right now when you're listening to this. Believe it or not, this nifty invention was actually created by a blind man named Ralph Teeter. Born in Hagerstown, Indiana in 1890, Ralph had normal vision until one day his hand slipped while he was working with a knife. The blade of the knife penetrated his eye, and within a year he was completely blind. But he never let his condition define him. Ralph continued pursuing his passions for tinkering and machinery, and by the age of 13, he had built a car prototype of his own. Apparently, it was capable of going 25 miles per hour, which was very fast for any vehicle, let alone a hobby car at that time. And Ralph graduated from the University of Pennsylvania in 1912 with a degree in mechanical engineering. He eventually joined the family business, which was called Perfect Circle Corporation, as lead engineer. However, Ralph's genius invention was not born until he hit peak annoyance with his driver. So remember, Ralph was blind, so he had a driver that got him around. And in his mind, cruise control, which is what it would be called, was born out of necessity because his driver had a habit of varying his speed based on whether or not he was speaking, which caused excessive braking, speeding up, slowing down, and frankly, motion sickness, which I struggle with myself. I'm always getting car sick. So I can't imagine how Ralph felt, especially in this time period. In response to this, and for the sake of his sanity, Ralph began working on an automotive speed control device, and this would regulate the speed of a vehicle without the use of the gas or brake pedals. Ralph received a patent for what he named, quote, the Speedostat in 1945, and the device, as we know, was later named cruise control, and eventually it became a standard feature in nearly all automobiles. So we have windshield wipers being invented by a woman. We have cruise control being invented by a blind man. And next up in the realm of interesting, very important stories is the history of the seatbelt. As we all know, seatbelts have not always been a thing. Even now, a lot of people don't wear them. You always hear stories, or at least I do, my parents saying like, oh, back in the 80s, no one wore a seatbelt, In fact, they were not widely used or adopted until about 50 years ago. For perspective, cars have been around since 1885, which is 139 years. Seatbelts have had quite the evolution in the automotive industry. Like I said, even though they were invented, 50 years ago, that doesn't mean people have used them. There was actually a prevailing myth at the time, back in the day, that it was safer to be flung from the car without a seatbelt on than to remain stuck inside of it after it crashed and caught on fire. Manufacturers at the time also believed that if the cars had too many safety features, it was an indication that the car was actually unsafe and hence it would not sell, which is very interesting if you think about it. It's like, oh, you know, this car has 25 safety features. Oh, the fact that it has safety features means it's actually unsafe. Like, make it make sense. It does not, the math is not mathing. And yet that was just the prevailing belief at the time. Nonetheless, the concept of a restraint or safety harness in a vehicle was not a bad idea to some, like Sir George Cayley. In the mid-1800s, Sir Cayley, who was a wealthy landowner from Yorkshire, England, invented the first two-point seatbelt, meaning it just went across the passenger's lap, but he didn't apply it to automobiles. No, he was actually more so interested in its applications to flight. Fun fact, he actually is credited with building the first successful manned glider half a century before the Wright brothers. Fun fact. This glider that he invented was affixed with his seatbelt invention, and it was a fairly successful design. In fact, actually, his first test flight crash landed. So, you know, it wasn't, they crash landed, indicating something went wrong, but the pilot survived because of his seatbelt. So hailing from Yorkshire, he invented the first two-point seatbelt, but he didn't patent his design. The credit actually goes, the patent credit goes to Edward Claghorn of New York City. Claghorn's 1885 seatbelt design was intended for vehicles, not airplanes. And apparently, it was made in order to keep tourists safe as they rode in taxis around the city. It always goes back to taxis, guys. And his design was very similar to Sir George Cayley's design in that it was a two-point seatbelt that straps across the lap, but there were two hooks on either side of the car seat, and the strap then fastened to both hooks. So just kind of imagine this. It was very rudimentary compared to the seatbelts that we know of today. Frankly, there were many iterations of the seatbelt before the V-type, which is the three-point seatbelt that we use today. So like the one that goes across the chest, click, you know, across the waist. So it has that three points of securing to the car, if you can picture that. But there were many, many iterations before we landed on that in about 1959. For example, a cross between the two-point seatbelt and a climbing harness was implemented into Indy 500 cars in 1922. Because obviously Indy 500, like, there's so many accidents that happen in that sport. And I feel like it makes a lot of sense that they would be, you know, trying whatever possible to save those guys. And it was specifically requested by Barney Oldfield, who was a racing pioneer and the first person to drive over 60 miles per hour. Yes, Barney. Barney was going fast. Fast and furious, over 60 miles per hour. He recruited a parachute manufacturer to help with the design in the car because it was not uncommon for Indy 500 drivers at the time to, like I said, get severely injured and die after being ejected from their vehicles in a crash. So he was just trying to increase his odds at survival. But many experts in the industry, like the team at Volvo, you might have heard of Volvo, these experts at Volvo were not satisfied with the safety features on the market at the time. And that's when a man named Niels Bohlen enters our story, and he is the hero of today's story. Niels invented the V-type three-point safety belt while he was working as the chief safety engineer at Volvo. First and foremost, let's start with the story of Volvo, because it's actually very interesting. You know, where did they come from? Who are they? What were they doing before they hired Niels in 1958? Well, obviously we know Volvo is a car brand, but more importantly, they are the epitome of innovation, safety, and Swedish engineering. Volvo Cars was founded in 1927 in Gothenburg, Sweden, as a subsidiary of the SKF Group, a leading manufacturer of bearings. The company's founders, Assar Gabrielsson and Gustav Larsson, aimed to produce vehicles that were well-suited to the harsh Scandinavian climate and terrain. The first Volvo car, called the OV4, affectionately known as Jacob, rolled off the assembly line on April 14th, 1927. It's funny, like, actually quite cute that they gave it a pet name, Jacob. It was robust and reliable, designed to withstand the rigors of the Swedish roads. Like I said, all of the different climate and terrain, things were kept in mind. And despite initial challenges, including a global economic downturn, Volvo persevered and established a reputation for quality and durability. And throughout the 1930s and the 1940s, Volvo expanded its product lineup, including a range of passenger cars, trucks, and buses. And the company's commitment to safety was evident early on with innovations like laminated glass windshields, padded dashboards, and safety door locks becoming standard features in Volvo vehicles. So it was no surprise that in 1959, Volvo made automotive history with the invention of the three-point seatbelt by engineer Niels Bohlin. A relative of Volvo CEO Gunnar Englo died in a car crash. So this motivated the company to increase safety measures even more drastically. It's sad that it took, a personal death for it to happen, but it happened. It got the fire under their butts and made them, start to focus on safety even more. But let's talk a bit more about Niels Bohlin, because I know all this, safety talk has been extremely riveting, but his story is the one we're going to focus on here. So Niels Ivar Bohlin, creator of the modern automotive seatbelt, was born on July 17th, 1920 in Härnösand, Sweden. In 1939, Niels got his Bachelor of Science degree in mechanical engineering, and then in 1942, he began working for Saab Aircraft Company as an aircraft designer. He designed their ejector seats for Saab fighter airplanes in the 1950s, and then he was hired at Volvo in 1958 to help them change the automobile safety landscape with new seatbelts. So he had experience working for fighter jets, these ejector seats that would, let the person fly out and parachute down to safety. So he understood safety. And that's why Volvo hired him. And he also had a great degree and whatnot. So his solution to the safety concerns was a three-point seatbelt that used one continuous belt. So just like the one we have today, one section would, go diagonally across the body while the other section crossed over the lap, creating a restraint for both the upper and lower body. In designing the new seatbelt, Niels concentrated on providing a more effective method of protecting the driver and the passenger against the impact of the swift deceleration that occurs when a car crashes. Because, as you can imagine, when a car crashes, it goes from, speeding along to stopping. No speed is happening and it's just impact, right? So the new belt secured both the upper and the lower body. Its straps were joined at hip level and buckled into what Niels called, quote, an immovable anchorage point below the hip so they could hold the body safely in the event of a crash. According to Niels, as quoted by the New York Times in his 2002 obituary, it was just a matter of finding a solution that was simple, effective, and could be put on conveniently with just one hand. And here's the kicker with all of this, and this is what really enticed me to read this story and to share this with you guys. So the most remarkable thing, the most significant thing about this invention that Niels created is what Volvo, because of course, he worked for Volvo, so Volvo owned the invention and the knowledge. Volvo had this technology and they gave it away for free. The company allowed other manufacturers from all these other car brands, competitors of theirs, to have Niels design free of cost, all in the name of safety. They're like, you know what? This obviously sets us apart. It's something we can market. It's something that, will entice drivers to, purchase cars from us because we have this state-of-the-art technology. But, we care about all people. We want everyone to have access to, Niels' design, to Niels' work, so everyone can use it in their cars. And at the time of Niels' death in 2002, Volvo estimated that his invention had saved more than 1 million lives in just four decades. The first car to feature the three-point seatbelt was the Volvo PV544, but others were soon to come after that, partly due to the proven safety enhancements, but partly because it started to become mandated by the state and then the federal lawmakers in the U.S. Like I said earlier, just because they were in cars didn't mean that people had to wear them. And you might hear, again, my parents love to be like, oh yeah, in the back seat, people didn't have to wear them, only in the front seat. Like there's all these laws and things. And, of course, something like this takes time for people to actually listen. And you know, unfortunately, a lot of times it takes tragedy or, you know, seeing what other people did and could have done to prevent, you know, you hear about these stories of someone's life being saved because of the seatbelt. So that kind of course, rubs off on people. And then they start to pay attention and realize that it's something that's worth doing, right? But it's so interesting. Let's talk about the legislative history of seatbelts as it pertains to the laws and in different places, because it's actually really interesting. So in 1961, Wisconsin became the first state in the United States to require seatbelts in cars. As you can imagine, it didn't go over extremely well. You know, it was such a foreign idea. Like I said, people weren't even using seatbelts on their kids in their cars, let alone, you know, themselves and other adults. So this was, you know, it became law in 1961, but it wasn't until 1968 when, you know, another law was released. I guess released, is that how you say it? It was passed? That's it. I'm trying to remember Schoolhouse Rock. So this was 7 years later, and this was a big law. So in 1968, the first federal law mandating all new cars be equipped with both lap and shoulder belts in the front seat was passed. And this was called the National Traffic and Motor Vehicle Safety Act. The National Highway Transportation Safety Administration, well, quite the mouthful, that one, was established just 2 years later to try to obviously enforce this. So again, there was nothing, you know, requiring that passengers wear the seatbelts. So then we entered a particularly tumultuous time for seatbelts. Like, yeah, there were laws, but it was like, you know, was a police officer or anyone going to enforce it? Like, that was kind of the problem here, was the enforcement. In 1973, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration required all new cars to install a seatbelt interlock mechanism. You might be like, what is that? Well, it's actually a very inexpensive device that was put into these cars, and it prevented a car from starting until the driver's seatbelt was buckled. So of course, we don't have this now necessarily, but we have that annoying little beeping thing that happens if people aren't buckled up. And I'm saying that only because, like, if you've had a car that has this, even if you put like a heavy bag or like, you know, some groceries or something on that seat next to you, like, it will beep unless you can find a way to turn it off, which is just sometimes annoying. But I get it. Here's the thing. I get it why it's implemented, but this sounds kind of like the early version of that. Like, you literally could not start your car if you have a new car without being buckled, you know, because they were thinking to themselves, what good are seatbelts if people aren't wearing them? Of course, though, you know, this is something new. It's the 70s. People rioted. They were not okay with this. They felt like the government was overreaching. Like, this was just so unnecessary to them. And, you know, this also impacted the sale of new cars because people are like, wait, I don't want to buy a new car if this is what's going to come with it, right? They're like, I'd rather just buy a used car. Slash, also, the automakers were like, this is, quote, expensive for us to add this feature to all new cars. Like, they claim it's inexpensive, but also it is a cost at the end of the day. And people, these consumers aren't happy. So why are we doing this? Like, what's the point? So Congress then responded by nixing the law the very next year. So it only lasted for a year. Then, so it's 1977 now, after the interlock mechanism law was denied, the NHTSA, so the Safety Administration, wouldn't take no for an answer. So they came back with a rule stating that car makers must include some sort of passive restraint that worked automatically without driver intervention and protected passengers when hitting a wall at 35 miles per hour. You might visualize, I don't know why I know this. I guess maybe there was a commercial a while back with some car maker showing like what happens if a car slams into a wall, like what happens to the dummy dolls, the test dolls. At this point, it seemed all but certain that automakers would be made to include seatbelts in their vehicles. And then the 1980 presidential election turned things upside down. Ronald Reagan ran his campaign around deregulation. That was his thing. Naturally, when he took office, he opposed a law that forced the manufacturers to do something against their will. This requirement was thus revoked. So things seemed to be going in a direction where car makers would at least have to have seatbelts in every car, no matter the state. But then Ronald Reagan was like, you know, working on deregulating businesses. And this then affected the seatbelt industry or the car making industry. But there was a second industry at play here. insurance companies. They had a vested interest in the safety of passengers, so they sued the Reagan administration for ignoring federal safety regulations. This case made it all the way to the Supreme Court, and in 1983, they ruled unanimously in favor of the insurers and ordered the Department of Transportation to reinstate the seatbelt requirement. Then, in 1984, New York became the first state to require the use of seatbelts in the front seat. And they say the rest is history. But now that seatbelts are so mainstream, have you ever considered how we tested the effectiveness of the seatbelt? Or for that matter, any other safety components in a car? You know, what comes to mind for me is the fact that I'm sure, you know, the seatbelts, the early kind of primitive seatbelts that Niels worked on and whatnot, maybe didn't include, you know how when you have a seatbelt on and you go too far forward, it locks? And I remember as a kid, like, always having an issue where I, like, got locked in my seatbelt because I was, like, flailing around too much in it. So things like that, you know, I'm just wondering, like, you know, when did those come to be? And, like, what other safety requirements are there out there? And, like, how do they test these things? You know, crash tests. Like I said, the Super Bowl commercial of it all, like, you always see these commercials where, like, the dummies go flying in the car, or they don't because they're strapped in, or, you know, whatever. In 1934, it was General Motors who became the first car maker to crash test its vehicles. By the 1950s, universities like Cornell, UCLA, and Wayne State began conducting their own crash tests, which proved the effectiveness of vehicle safety features, and most notably, the seatbelt. Several decades later, the NHTSA began crash testing as well. And in 1978, the agency conducted its first crash test, a 35-mile-per-hour frontal collision. So in these early tests in the 1970s, when they were testing cars, they didn't obviously have any humans in the car to operate it. They just had it kind of go on its own, either on a track or, you know, they just, I don't know how they did it, it doesn't really matter, but they didn't have anything or anyone inside of the car. But it soon became apparent to everybody that they needed to know the impact on human bodies, because after all, like, yeah, the car, whatever happens to the car happens, but what's it going to do to the person inside of it? Like, you know, just because the car crashes doesn't mean the person in it, you know, maybe the car crashes and stays contained, but the person inside might suffer serious consequences, but we don't know because we're not going to obviously put a human life at risk by putting it in the car. So it's actually quite morbid what they did to figure out the implication on human bodies, like what would happen if it crashes into a wall at 35 miles per hour. Before they used crash test dummies, which, you know, of course are like these mannequin looking things, they actually used cadavers. Yes, dead bodies. They were the best thing to use to test how a crash affected a human body, or so they thought. After some tests, it became obvious that dead bodies do not react the same way that living, breathing, warm, moving bodies do. Plus, once test crashing progressed to include survivability, so like whether or not the person survives or not from the crash, they simply could not be measured with a cadaver for obvious reasons. Like, this person is dead, you know. Hence, researchers moved to using animal test subjects, from monkeys to bears. But apparently the most common animal was a pig because they have the same thoracic and abdominal organs as humans, which I didn't actually think about that, but yeah. And this was also a good idea at the time, but it didn't provide practical crash test data. I'm trying to picture like these pigs strapped into, it's just, I mean, it's obviously animal cruelty, but like it just is a funny picture to me. Like, hopefully they were okay, but anyway, enter. This is where the crash test dummy enters the scene, finally. They were first used in the 1940s, actually, when the Air Force tested aircraft ejection seats. So, like I said, the ejection seats came first, then the seatbelts. This was back in the 1940s when they were first used. But the first crash test dummy specifically designed for automotive testing debuted in 1968. Up until the early 1970s, crash test dummies were supplied by independent companies. This all changed when General Motors became dissatisfied with the options on the market and developed its own instead. So in 1971, the automaker created the Hybrid One dummy, as it was called, which incorporated features from the VIP series that was used before, along with those from Sierra Engineering and some of General Motors' own designs. So it's kind of like, it was literally a hybrid. That's why it's called that. It was just combined all the other technologies together. And it was followed the next year by the Hybrid 2, which more closely mimicked human anatomy and provided consistent results. These early hybrid dummies created by GM were primarily designed to test the effectiveness of seatbelts. A more sophisticated dummy would be needed eventually to determine, you know, the effects of a crash on the head, neck, and limbs, including those of different genders, ages, and sizes. So GM took all of this into account, you know, all of these different factors, because of course it matters, you know, the person's height, the person's weight, you know, the person's gender, I suppose. So GM solved this, kind of made things a bit more fine-tuned, a bit more customized, or what's the word, catered to these different factors. They figured this out before the close of the decade with the introduction of the Hybrid 3. So they'd done the Hybrid 1, Hybrid 2, they moved on to Hybrid 3. And not only was it the most human-like crash test dummy ever made, it contained 41 channels of information, while the Hybrid 2 had just 8. This allowed researchers to precisely measure injuries to susceptible parts of the body, including the head, torso, and legs. Other than their benefit to researchers, perhaps the best thing to come out of the invention of crash test dummies was Vince and Larry. In the early 1980s, only about 20% of Americans were wearing seatbelts. Like I said, my parents said this, you know, it's like the 80s. People were like, okay, we have these things called seatbelts now, but it took effort to get people to actually wear them. To try to increase that number, the NHTSA unveiled a new advertising campaign featuring two crash test dummies named Vince and Larry. So very similar to like what I mentioned before, the more modern, obviously I didn't see these ads because it was the 80s, but you know, I wasn't even born yet. I was negative 15, but you know, I've seen Super Bowl commercials that kind of closely mimic this invention or the marketing invention of Vince and Larry. In each of the advertisements, the dummy duo, Vince and Larry, experienced a series of painful consequences for not wearing a seatbelt. I'm actually going to, after this, text my parents and ask if they know, or send a picture of Vince and Larry if they know of this, because apparently it was very widespread, this advertising concept, with a tagline, quote, "You could learn a lot from a dummy." It was sure to stick in people's minds, and it actually did. And the marketing campaign actually worked wonders. Seatbelt use in America doubled the year after Vince and Larry made their national debuts. By the time the campaign ended in 1998, roughly 70% of vehicle occupants were wearing their seatbelts. So Vince and Larry, gotta look up a picture of them. I'll put them on the Instagram, Found Objects podcast. I'll post a photo of them. But they're a key part of history, so much so that you can actually see them proudly displayed at the Smithsonian. So as you can gather from this episode, there's a lot of very interesting components that go into, and a lot of interesting people for that matter, that go into the car that we know today. And the journey from that clunky automobile from the past to the modern car was a long but necessary one, you know, one that people at first didn't quite understand, or, you know, they had to work out some kinks along the way, like, oh, the car's not going to, you know, turn on if you don't have your seatbelt buckled. Like, that was obviously an oversight. That was something that wasn't going to stick, but that led to, you know, the way that we know cars to be today. And the car is not just a mode of transportation, it's a reflection of human ambition and progress. And the invention of windshield wipers to crash test dummies all played a very important role in evolving our cars to be as safe as possible. And you guys know I love a good invention story, so I hope you guys enjoyed this episode discussing a few very big inventions that we know to just be standard today. And of course, this was, you know, a lot of U.S. history. Things are much different in other countries, but if I was going to talk about every country, I'd be here all day long, and I don't know if you guys really care that much, to be honest with you, about every single country's seatbelt laws and such. You know, it's a lot of reciting laws and such, but it's very interesting how things took shape here where I'm sitting today. And, you know, just knowing every time I see a taxi whiz by or any, you know, Uber I get in, I'm going to be thinking about the seatbelts and the windshield wipers and all of that. And I'm sure you guys will too, now that you've listened to this story in full. So thank you guys for joining us today, taking a drive with me through history, as I wrote down to say. Hopefully, today on Found Objects, you learned something completely outside of your wheelhouse. Join us next week for more nuggets of history lost with time. And with that, guys, thank you all for listening. And remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
Now Taxes is 100% free when you file in the TurboTax app if you didn't file with us last year.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Just do your own taxes in the app by 2/18.
What if I have lots of forms?
All good. All 100% free.
What if I had three jobs?
Still 100% free.
What if I once saw Bigfoot?
That has nothing to do with taxes, so still 100% free.
Now that's what I'm talking about.
Now this is taxes. See if you qualify in the TurboTax app. Excludes TurboTax Live. Must start and file in app by 2/18.